hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Woolforth. Do you remember 1985? I certainly do. It's when oil prices crashed and the Alaska economy went in the dumps. In fact, that's kind of putting it mildly. I think 14 banks and savings and loans went out of business in the crash that took place. Now we're seeing oil prices go down again, as of today, down to $48 a barrel. Does that mean the same thing's going to happen again, or has Alaska changed enough that we're somewhat insulated from those economic doldrums that we saw before? We've got three experts in the studio to talk about this today, to put it in context. We're going to be focusing on the Anchorage and the South Central economy. It's not a show about the state budget or the decisions that Governor Walker has to make, although those are very important. We're going to try to figure out what this means to you, your neighborhood, your housing prices, your job, and hope we'll hear from you with your questions. For a top flight expert panel who's been in front of these microphones before and should be able to give us some good answers. So with me in the studio is Scott Goldsmith. He's an emeritus professor at University of Alaska from Institute of Social and Economic Research. Thanks for being with us, Scott.
Good to be here.
Neil Fried, economist with the Alaska Department of Labor. I think I've been interviewing Neil for about 25 years now. Thanks for being with us, Neil.
Great to be here.
And Bill Popp, the president and CEO at the Alaska Economic Development Corporation.
Also good to be here.
Thanks for being with us. And your calls are very much wanted. What do you like to know about the economic picture that's facing Alaska? It's facing Anchorage. Are you scared? Do you think you should be? Specifics about how our economy works and how it might affect you. The phone number, if you're in the Anchorage area, is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And email works as well. Just email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And I want to start talking with you, Scott Goldsmith. You've done economic modeling of Alaska and how the Alaska economy works from a macro perspective for many years, and have made lots of predictions and analyses over the years. For the relative novice, why is everybody watching the price of oil every day? Why is that so important for what's happening to ordinary people in Anchorage?
It's important because about a third of all the jobs in Alaska can be traced directly or indirectly to the oil industry and the price of oil. And those jobs have come from three main avenues. One is just the activities of the industry in the oil patch on the North Slope. Those are the highest paying jobs in the state, and the industry also spends billions of dollars buying services within the economy, transportation services, warehousing services, so on and so forth, to for the exploration and development activities that are ongoing on the slope. So that's one avenue. Second avenue, of course, is all the revenues that the industry pays to the state, both through taxes and royalties. And together, those support about a third of the jobs in the economy. What people don't recognize is that there's more to the industry than those two direct approaches. One, those direct lines. One is that because the oil industry pays about 90 to 95% of the revenues in the state, that means the rest of us, be they businesses or households, pretty much have a free ride in terms of taxation. So we're lightly taxed, and
so
we
that
have
benefits the economy.
Yeah, we have more money in our pocket to go out to dinner with our families and to go to the Target and other stores and so on and so forth. And the the other industries in the state as well have a greater capability to develop the other natural resources because they're lightly taxed. So that's just an example of another way that the that the state has benefited from oil and how important it is for the economy.
So a person who doesn't work for state government or for an oil company, but works sort of in private industry, I suppose the federal government would be another issue, but works in private industry, how does a drop in oil price trickle down to that person?
Well, on the one hand, it's positive because when they go to the gas pump, it's a lot cheaper, and they have more money left over in their pocket to to spend somewhere else. But on the other hand, not only does a lower oil price put a strain on the ability of state and local government to provide basic services, you know, everything from education to police and so on, but it also puts a potential strain on private businesses in the state and the ability of those businesses to continue to provide services to the broader community.
Right, right. And I remember that in the last crash, hopefully this isn't another crash, but the crash happened before, all kinds of businesses went belly up because there was nobody coming in the door. Slower economic growth.
And the other thing, of course, is that a falling tide drops all boats, in the sense that anyone who has a home, has an investment in housing, when demand falls because of slowdown in the economy, well, that affects their housing values. So even if you're in the fishing industry or in the mining industry, you're going to feel that effect if the petroleum sector declines.
Right. Well, let me turn to Neil Fried, because we're talking about jobs and how the decline in oil prices could affect jobs, not only in the oil industry and state government, also just sort of Main Street jobs. Neil, are you seeing any impact on jobs yet? I realize that prices only just crashed in a couple of months. Has there been anything that's happened in terms of the data that you look at?
No, we haven't seen anything yet that we can say or is associated with what's going on right now. The lag time is just, you know, the most recent data, we're coming out with our December numbers, for example, in a couple of weeks. But no, we have not. But the numbers have been sort of interesting. You know, we've had quite the run, you know, since the recovery in the late 80s. You know, Anchorage basically grew almost uninterruptedly, almost. There were a few, like in 2009, grew moderately for almost 25 years. But, you know, sort of interestingly, and this isn't tied to what is happening right now, but last year we basically were flat, and the previous year as well. We sort of have gone horizontal the last couple of years. So we've, you know, experienced very, very moderate growth. And in fact, this last year, we it looks like we lost a little bit of ground. I mean, less than 0.5%.
So what we'd expect, I guess, would be that as oil prices go down, if oil companies cut their budgets, then we'll start to see layoffs at the oil companies. And then sort of in the past, when you've seen sort of this pattern happen before, how does that flow through? What happens after that?
Well, you know, and you know, it's sort of interesting right now. I mean, like Scott said, there's sort of two sides. There's the industry and their employment, and then there's, you know, the other employment that's tied to sort of the runoff of that industry, but also to oil revenues. You know, right now, there's a record number of people on the North Slope. I mean, we have over 12,000 people up there, and we've never seen that in our history. Even though we're producing a quarter of as much oil as we were. You know, those numbers have just been really steadily climbing for 5 or 6 years. And, you know, about a third of those folks that are in Prudhoe live here in Anchorage. And more than a third, probably closer to half, live in South Central, if you define that as Anchorage in the Mat-Su Valley. So you have that big group. And then, of course, there are a lot of people in Anchorage that live here and work in the industry that is physically here, like at the headquarters for the different oil companies. You know, so you have those, you know, you have that side. And we haven't seen anything yet, but that's the other. And it's really hard to guess what's going to happen. Price is very important. It's very fundamental, and sometimes we forget that. When an organization is making a lot of money, it doesn't matter what kind of organization they are, they're going to be spending a lot of money. When they're making less, they're going to spend less. Mm-hmm. How long that's going to take, no one's told us yet.
Right. It's not like they're going to shut down business up there, but they, in the past at least, what we've seen is that those employment numbers from the oil companies are sort of the first thing to go down.
Well, I mean, in the longer run, there's a strong correlation between price and employment.
Right.
I mean, they are both very important.
Hard to get around, yeah. So, Bill Popp, you have, from the Anchorage Economic Development Corp, you have constant contact with business leaders in Anchorage and discussion about the economy, unique economic predictions. What are you hearing from your members, from business leaders in Anchorage, about
their feelings about the future. Are people worried? Is there sort of a mood out there?
Well, we've been out on the street back in November, December with our Business Confidence Index survey, and I'm going to be sharing the results of that at the beginning of February at our event at the Denina Center. But what we came away from with that survey, is just to give you a sense of it, is a similar model that we saw back in 2008, 2009, when the global recession was kicking in. There was a real recognition on their individual business basis that they were doing fine. And that's what our numbers are showing us right now, that they feel pretty good about their own companies. But then when you ask them the question, how's the broader economy going to do, a little more pessimistic, not, you know, to the point of time to go up and climb on the cliff edge and jump, but they really feel that there is trouble on the horizon. So what they're waiting for right now, what I'm hearing, those that are talking to me about this, is they're trying to wait and see where this is going to manifest itself. Are the oil companies going to start pulling back is what they're watching first. More importantly, in the longer term, is what state government is going to do, because that's a substantial entity in our economy in the number of government employees statewide and here in Anchorage that work for the state of Alaska. And what they've been expressing to me is if the legislature and the governor choose to take a scalpel to the budget, they're going to be okay with that and they're going to be a little less pessimistic. If there's a move to take a hatchet to the budget, then they're going to be a lot more pessimistic.
So a lot of it is just watching what happens in this upcoming legislative session as people sort of looked at that for the tea leaves.
It's one of the two indicators. I mean, the price is what the price is. It's interesting. Historically, we've been here before not too long ago in terms of a price crash. 2008, $147 a barrel, if I remember correctly, on one day that year for North Slope crude. Down into the low 30s, I believe $32 a barrel several months later, and then before the year could end, back up in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
That's another lesson that a lot of businesses have taken to heart
in
remembering
see.
That
yeah.
history is, you know, this is a different price swing. This is being driven by different issues. This is a price war, basically, a supply war between different suppliers. OPEC has made a decision that they are going to run production out of the market by continuing to pump. And when the price finds the bottom, production will fall out of the marketplace and then the price will recover. Department of Energy came out and said that they think that the price is going to recover up into the mid-70s by 2016. You can find other speculations that it's going to stay in the 40s. It's kind of, you know, Ouija board speculation right now.
Predictions never seem to be right.
Maybe magic eight ball. How about that?
So in terms of the behavior of local businessmen, I would think that if they are worried about what the world is going to look like in 6 months to a year, they're probably not going to be investing in growth. And that is, to some extent, a self-fulfilling prophecy. If nobody's investing in growth, then there'll likely be that much less growth taking place.
Well, it depends on the kind of growth you're talking about. You know, the retail market in Anchorage is looking very, very positive for 2015. A lot of new investment, mainly from outside firms, but from some local firms also that are investing in retail, restaurants. Very significant investments, again, taking place next year. Very strong employment going on. We've got to remember, last month's preliminary number, or the last reporting period's preliminary numbers for unemployment in Anchorage was 4.8%. You know, if we're going to have to absorb some losses, that's a pretty good place to start from.
Yeah, we are strong. It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about oil prices and the economy today. And I have three guests. You're just hearing from Bill Popp, president and CEO of the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, Neil Fried, an economist with the Alaska Department of Labor, and Scott Goldsmith, emeritus professor at the Institute for Social and Economic Research. And now I'd like to turn to a caller. Table, a question about lower oil prices and Medicaid funding.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. Charles, I appreciate the opportunity to ask the question about Medicaid. I do know from having run most recently a large assisted living home for people with chronic mental illness, I do know that they are supported in a vast portion of Medicaid funding, which is funded pretty much by the state of Alaska. And I know in order to keep them in housing, general relief always contributes a good portion towards their funding through Medicaid. how will a downturn in the economy affect housing for people with disabilities and seniors that use the general relief fund to make up the difference between their benefit check from Social Security and maintaining their housing in Alaska?
So I guess that's a question about continued funding of these programs that are providing that income. Scott, that kind of goes to whatever the legislature decides to pay for, right?
That's certainly true. I think it's safe to say that a large share of the safety net that you're describing, at least the ongoing safety net, is actually covered by the federal government. More than half of Medicaid, which is a huge program, it's probably the largest program of state government, when you include both state and federal dollars. More than half of that comes from the federal government. And my understanding is that if we were to go ahead and expand the Medicaid program, that almost all of that additional money required would, at least for the first couple of years, come from the feds. So in the near term, if you're looking at things that would prop up the economy, that's something that would be positive. Now, the long term, it's a little bit more complicated because over time, the state would have to pick up a larger share of the payment for that expansion. But certainly in the near term, that would be a positive for the economy because it brings more dollars into the economy from outside.
Right. And they're dollars that are actually being spent. There's nobody, it's going right out on the street for services and so quick impact.
Right, yeah. Right.
All right. Thanks for that question. If other listeners have questions or comments or concerns about what's happening with lower oil prices in the economy, the number to call here at Hometown Alaska is 550-8433. Out of town, it's 888-353-5752, and email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. Scott, I wanted to put the current situation in the context for what some of us, I guess you have to probably be around 50 or older to actually remember going through everybody here qualifies.
Charles, you don't remember.
I remember. In fact, I was lucky enough to come back from college and buy my first house at the bottom of that 1980s crash and got a 2,400 square foot house for $90,000, which
buy low, sell high.
And so in the end, I guess I didn't suffer that much, but it was a tough time to see so many people out of work, so many people leaving town, so many businesses closing. For those who don't remember it, give us a little bit of a thumbnail sketch of what happened in the 80s, what sort of how those low oil prices worked their way through the economy.
Population fell by 10%. This is statewide. Employment fell by probably 10%. As you already mentioned, half the banks in the state went belly up, and that was largely because the construction industry, both residential construction and broader commercial construction, totally tanked. And the foreclosure rate skyrocketed. The value of people's homes just went through the toilet, so it was a tough time economically.
And something like 5 years before the average homeowner was back in the black on their mortgage, there was a huge underwater segment.
It took a long time, and what it really took to pull the economy out was the Exxon Valdez oil spill, because that brought billions of dollars into the economy. And gave the economy a real boost. But I think it's important to talk about and understand the differences between that time and this time around.
Yeah, certainly. That was going to be my next question. I want to have you all weigh in on that. Uh-huh. But, that was a time when the state government spending was highly inflated. There was sort of a go-go thing going on, and then it was cut off cold turkey, and so it was a precipitous crash. And we don't see that. I mean, we've got a lot of reserves now, so it's a bit different.
That's you're absolutely right. And if you look at where the job loss was, it was really concentrated in the construction industry, which went through a boom bust of incredible proportions through that decade. construction employment in the decade started at 10,000, and it doubled to 20,000 over a period of 5 years. And so that's what it was when the oil price crashed. And the oil price crash just took the bottom out of the construction industry, and employment fell back to 10,000 over a period of 2 or 3 years. And that, as you point out, that's something that we won't repeat, because the economy, as you say, is not in go-go situation today as it was back then. So that's one of the important differences. There are many others.
So, Neil, in terms of jobs, obviously there was a huge loss of jobs. Was it a lot of construction jobs primarily, and do we have fewer construction jobs in the economy now?
You know, I think one point, and we sort of alluded to this, is this was a classic boom-bust event, which is very different environment than we're in today. We're certainly not in a boom environment by any means, and that makes a big difference. As far as employment losses—
We don't have as far to fall, basically.
Right, that's exactly right. You know, and it was a lot of things. We lost about 14,000 jobs between 1986 and 1988. A third of those were in construction. Construction has never gotten back to those heights again. I mean, absolute numbers, even though our economy is way bigger today than it was then, the absolute number of people in construction is still smaller now than it was then, which is sort of amazing to think about. It kind of gives you an idea. We built 9,000 or permitted 9,000 housing units in 1983. We've permitted 9,000 in the last 10 years in Anchorage.
Wow.
You know, and we have 85,000 more people living here. So, you know, it was a very different environment, but it did touch every industry. I looked at the numbers recently. Retail got hit hard. Services got hit. Local government, state government got hit as well. I mean, it was pretty broad, but construction definitely contributed to the biggest losses. And I think part of it was, it wasn't just that the state quit spending money, you know, capital budget, but everyone was sort of getting ahead. If we remember at that time, we thought this boom was going to go on forever. You know, we just thought the oil, you know, there's a shortage of oil in the world, the price is going to keep going up. You know, so private investment went way ahead of demand. I mean, you could even see that before the crash began in 85, 84. When we look at the vacancy rates, they started climbing. Commercial, there was more office space. We were sort of getting ahead of ourselves already, and then the rug got pulled out from underneath us. So it was just a super classic boom bust. Probably aren't...
Kind of similar to what the whole country went through in 2008.
Sort of.
Yeah.
Ours was really sort of a very classic, almost like a gold rush kind of thing.
Right. So when you compare the industries we have now and how many jobs each industry provides compared to what existed like in the early 80s, it seems like we have some industries we didn't have then. We have a huge air freight industry. We have much more retail. Give us sort of the picture of how our economy has maybe diversified a bit, if that's true.
I think it's true, but it'd be interesting to hear what others say, because I'm not completely sure. I think the biggest change we've seen is we have a much bigger service sector in this economy. You know, we had oil and, you know, the construction and transportation, they dominated our economy in the 80s and the 70s and up, you know, from statehood. And then we've had this huge growth. Almost all of our growth in the 90s and even into the 2000s was not in the oil industry, but was in the service sectors. So now we have as many services. We've caught up with the rest of the country.
And what are those, like medical?
Medical health. Look at healthcare. You know, we're almost at where the rest of the country is. That has contributed, I think, maybe a third of the jobs during that period of time.
Wow.
You know, it's huge. And retail.
Is that because we're sort of a medical center for the state, or?
Part of it's that, part of it's the nation, part of it's our demographics. Part of it, I think, is catch up. You know, I think more people get their health care here instead of going somewhere else. I think that's true for a lot of services. You know, even entertainment, you know, you name it, you know. You've been here a long time, Charles. I mean, things have changed in that way quite dramatically. Right. And the other two things, you know, we've already talked about the cargo. The other is tourism. You know, the visitor industry has grown almost all those years and is a lot bigger than it was then. But, you know, revenues are still very important to a lot of those sectors. And the oil industry is also, you know, that cash coming into our economies.
If people lose their jobs, they're retail, not going to be getting operations and going to the hospital and all the other stuff. Right. So, Bill Popp, you were mentioning before the show that there's some good-looking trends in the air cargo industry.
Absolutely. Well, you know, so what Neil and Scott have talked about is the fact that our economy of our city has changed quite a bit since the mid-1980s. You know, it's important to remember what triggered that boom back in the 80s, and that was a state budget that went from about $780 million in 1978 to $5.3 billion in 1980. Mm-hmm. You know, if that's not putting match to gas, I don't know what is. And we have not had that going on here in recent years in terms of the state treasury. We've had significant increases, and we're going to have to pare that back. But it's not the classic boom has been previously described. So in Anchorage, our economy has diversified in ways since the 1980s that have been very positive. Air cargo is one of those big elements that has changed the landscape in Anchorage to a significant degree, to the point that even in the depths of the national recession, when numbers went way down for cargo, the Anchorage airport still accounted for about 1 out of 10 jobs in Anchorage, both directly and indirectly.
Amazing. And a lot of those are similar to the oil industry in that they're very well-paid jobs.
They're good jobs. Yeah. They're good jobs. A lot of them are. So we just got the preliminary tonnage numbers from the airport today, and we're reporting the best year we've had since 2007, pre-national recession. 4.4 million tons of air cargo transited through our airport, either inbound from Asia or outbound from the United States back to Asia. To put that into context, 2007 was about 4.5 million tons. That's a 17% increase.
Wow.
And I know that the Port of Anchorage is dealing with volumes of jet fuel going through the tank farm there that just completely surprised them this year. Now, part of this is the recovering national economy. Part of it has been a very nice little slowdown of work by the dock workers all up and down the West Coast. And part of it now is, again, one of those few silver linings that we as Alaskans can look to in a lower price of a barrel of oil, and that's cheaper jet fuel, which makes air cargo cheaper and a more affordable option, which means we're going to get some benefit from that in terms of tonnage, landings, and jobs at the airport.
How does that work through into sort of the rest of the economy? I mean, it seems like a big company like FedEx, if it goes up or down a little bit, they're not going to fire or hire pilots, right? I mean, there's quite a bit of business that's going to be there all the time. But do they need to expand their capacity when things are picking up and start hiring? And do we see that sort of in the numbers?
Well, I think if the trend continues, and you know, there's some optimistic signs that we'll see continued good growth in air cargo in 2015. We'll wait until we see these numbers refined a little bit more. We could see more pilots being hired, more ground handlers, more freight sorters for the sort facilities at FedEx and at UPS and at Linden and at Northern Air Cargo. And then the fact that we have pretty much every scheduled carrier operating in the Pacific Rim between the Pacific Rim and the United States is flying through Anchorage International Airport on its way to delivering cargo wherever it may be in North America. When we did our study in, I think it was 2009, 2010, about 82% of the air cargo entering North America lands in Anchorage International Airport first on its way from Asia into North America.
Wow.
That's an amazing number.
It really is. Before we go to the break, let's take a call. Bill is calling in, and I'm not totally sure what he wants to talk about, but Bill, what?
A couple things. I used to work at FedEx, and they used to have a sort on Saturday night with 7 airplanes. They don't have that anymore because of the 777. If you look over at UPS, they're flying the 747, and they don't do a lot of sorting here. They do some, but basically the 777 kind of writes Anchorage out of the equation as far as FedEx is concerned. Hmm. The other thing is Jay Hammond wanted to have a dollar income tax, if I remember correctly. Remember that back in the day?
He always regretted that he got rid of, or the income tax was repealed under his watch because he knew it would be very hard to bring back, and certainly it has proved over 40 years it has been, yeah.
Yeah, and if you're a politician, you really can't mention that. So I was thinking something maybe called the hat trick, like the Hammond Alaska tribute tax, have an upside-down beret, and just have people, you know, if you could go to the state somewhere and sign up and say, I wouldn't mind paying that dollar. Because if you're a politician, you mention income tax, you're going to get booed. You know what I mean? But if people got together and, you know, said, you know, we don't mind doing it, because this is sort of like an interstellar scenario. We're trying to live off of one crop, in this case, oil.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, anyway, I listened to that show yesterday, and I guess every Alaskan is responsible for $4,500 of deficit. And another idea is if we didn't take our permanent fund and let the state use the money. That would be complicated, but just in the spirit of the idea of trying to, you know, keep the state's coffers fuller, maybe instead we could just cap the permanent fund, and that way we'd have a defined cost.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Bill. And those are things that I think everybody's going to be talking about as we watch the state decisions coming down. I wasn't intending to sort of focus on that in today's show because we're trying to focus on impact on the local economy. But I think a good point you brought up is this $4,500 per person thing. And before we go to break, I just want to quickly get some perspective from Scott Goldsmith about how much money would be needed if we were to try to fill this gap. I was in a meeting recently and someone said, I've heard this a million times, well, let's just bring back the $10 per head school tax. And you'll say, okay, well, there's 600,000 people, $10 per head, that would be $6 million, right? You know, we only have another, what, $5 billion to go. And Scott, you know, what is the sort of, in terms of taxation, how much of this gap can we fill on taxation based on individuals in our state?
Most states have both an income tax and a sales tax. And if you look at the national average take on a per capita basis for those two taxes, it's about $1,800 per capita per year. So if we taxed at that rate here in Alaska, we would take in about $1.2 billion?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not an insignificant amount. It would make a big contribution to filling whatever size gap you want to try to fill. But, you know, there's no single silver bullet among the tools that we have.
Right. And just to put it in context, what is the current budget gap that we're looking at in round numbers?
$3 billion.
$3 billion. All right. Well, it's Hometown Alaska. We're going to have much more of this cheerful conversation. Stick with us. It's not all bad news. I think we're hearing that you don't need to panic, but you do need to kind of know what's going on. And so we're going to try to give you some more information about that in the second half. I'll also be giving out our phone numbers in case you want to get on the phone and ask a question or make a comment. So stick with us as Hometown Alaska continues.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're talking today about the economy, particularly how oil prices will affect the economy. Today, the price of oil went up about 5%. It's kind of amazing how much oil goes up and down in a single day, especially when you think about how much we rely on that number. And for that reason, Alaska has been designated as the state with the most volatile source of our basic economy. Because the way it jumps around, 5% in one day is too much. But in any event, we're at about $48 a barrel right now. And if you just throw that into an inflation calculator on the internet, you find out that's roughly equivalent to what would have been $26, $27 in 1985 when we had that big crash. At that time, I think oil got all the way down to like $9 a barrel. So it's not as bad as that. And also, we have a very different economy, as we learned in the first half. We have more industries now, and we don't have the same boom cycle going on. On the other hand, I don't think anybody's feeling really good about what's happening. So if you have questions or comments for our panel, please give us a call at 550-8433, 550-8433. And the toll-free number, if you're out of town, is 888-353-5752. And email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. One of the things that I think is interesting, Scott Goldsmith, is that we look at the national economy with relation to the Alaska economy, and it seems over time that there has often been a countercyclical element to that. In other words, when one's up, the other's down. The national economy was doing quite badly over the last 6 or 7 years. And Alaska has done reasonably well. But we seem to, in some ways, be more tied in than we used to. For example, the tourism business took quite a hit in 2008 when the national economy went down, and that affected us. Now, I guess the national economy going up, we've heard that air freight is increasing. Maybe tourism will increase too. How are we linked to the economy outside? What are some of the main factors there?
Well, I'd say that the main link is still through petroleum. And when prices are low, that's good for consumers, and it's not good for producers and vice versa. And I think that overshadows the any positive links that you can see through tourism, that you can see through air cargo, for example, or some of the other industries that in Alaska do well when the national economy is doing well. That may be the case, but oil still dominates the picture.
All right. So is that why we would tend to have a countercyclical thing? Because when the price goes down, it's good for everybody else because they're not paying so much at the pump and it's bad for us?
Well, it's good for everybody else relative to Alaska. I mean, you know, Texas is the number one oil producer, but they're much more diversified than we are. So they're going to lose on the production side, but they'll gain through their other industries. So they're still not as sensitive as Alaska is to falling oil price, nor is North Dakota for that matter.
Neil Fried, did you want to throw something in on
that? Yeah, I would, because there is that belief that we are counter-cyclical. And I think that was true. That sort of got embedded in the early 1970s when we were building TAPS. You know, the price of oil climbed to $5 a barrel. We were building the pipeline. The rest of the country was in one of its worst recessions. That's why so many people came. It wasn't just because of the paychecks, although that was a big attraction. So we had a big counter-cyclical going thing there because oil prices were so important to the American economy at that time because they were a much bigger input into the American economy than they are today. That happened again in the early 80s. You know, America went into this horrible recession. We went into this incredible boom. So there was that sort of counter-cyclical nature. But since then, that really has not been the case. Oil prices are less important to the American economy than they have been. We've seen the American economy thrive now at high oil prices. I don't think that there's a little bit of counter-cyclicalness there, but it's not very dramatic.
Mm-hmm. How does the imbalance of the economy nationally with the economy in Alaska affect the migration of workers in and out of the state? And sort of what pattern did we see during the national recession and what pattern would you expect to see upcoming?
Yeah, it's very, very predictable. I mean, we've looked at those numbers, and what typically happens is that if the rest of the country goes into a recession, we see a positive immigration of workers to Alaska. On the flip side, if the American economy is doing very well and we're maybe not doing so well or we're sort of stagnant, we will see an out-migration. So there's a very strong relationship between migration and how the two different economies are doing. Although, maybe I think it's dramatic because you can actually see it. We had a record, or not a record, but in the last 10 years, in 2010, we saw a very positive immigration number into Alaska and into Anchorage. As the American economy began to improve, that changed quite dramatically. But the absolute numbers were not that huge. But we're talking about maybe 10,000 versus 3,000. So there is definitely a correlation between the two. And that's always been true. That was even true when we were building the railroad, you know, when the American economy was cooking during World War I, and a lot of people left here to pursue opportunities elsewhere in the country.
So how does that affect just regular people here? Does it really matter in terms of?
It doesn't in a good way or bad way. You can look at it different ways. I mean, as people leave, it means there's less competition for those of us that stay looking for opportunity. And that in some ways can effectively pull down our unemployment rate. It really depends. On the other hand, if you're an employer looking for workers, it might be more difficult to find that workforce. So it depends on what side of the equation you're on.
Right. So Bill Popp, you're with the Economic Development Corporation, so you have your finger on what's actually happening with businesses right now. Are people having trouble finding employees?
I mean, we've been having trouble finding employees for several years, especially in the skilled and professional workforce. In fact, in our survey, I will let this out, that that's still one of the top five concerns for business in terms of a barrier to growth is the lack of availability of skilled and professional workforce in a number of different lines of industry.
Apparently, we're finding that with teachers, they can't hire enough teachers.
Absolutely, and yeah. that fits in that very model. But mm-hmm. From a business point of view, we're an expensive environment to do business in. I mean, we're the 23rd most expensive city in the United States, according to the cost of living index compared to the national average. And our housing market is one of our big drivers of that, accounting for over a third of that metric. And we are the 20th most expensive city in the United States for housing, comparatively speaking. And it's a tight market. It has been a tight market. You've got very low unemployment. We've got a lot of jobs going out there that are going unfilled, which is another, I think, shock absorber in the system right now. If we do start to see job losses, it'll be a short-term shock absorber, but it will help a little bit mm-hmm. in the fact that I've got any number of employers reporting jobs that have been going unfilled for months because of a lack of availability of workforce with the skills that they are looking for.
And what are some of the key jobs?
Oh, healthcare. It was business and professional services, although that's flattened out quite a bit. We're hearing IT industry is still a challenge for us. Mm-hmm. And then even now, retail is starting to become a real challenged industry in terms of finding workforce capable of filling the needs that they have. I mean, we had a very significant year of growth last year in retail. I, along with Neil, expect a fairly significant, good year of growth in retail in 2015, given the number of nameplates that are putting up new businesses in town. And, a lot of industries have been mm-hmm. challenged. And again, it reflects that low unemployment rate. And that unemployment rate is not limited to just Anchorage. Matsu has got unemployment that's at about a 10-year low. Mm-hmm. Kenai Peninsula has an unemployment rate that, as best we can tell, is the lowest it's been since this new metric was established 20-plus years ago.
Wow.
It's in single digits and very low unemployment, thanks to a fairly significant amount of activity in the oil and gas sector in Cook Inlet. Mm-hmm. And that we'll knock on wood and hope that that continues, because that could be another element that was different from the 1980s in terms of servicing our local utility markets, as well as the Tesoro refinery and the LNG plant down in Nikiski.
So if we start to see layoffs from some of these big employers, hopefully there's a place for those folks to go without leaving Alaska, and therefore you don't see the loss in housing prices and all the other things that go down, although they would presumably be going to lower paid jobs because they would switch right now if they could make as much, right?
I would think so.
Yeah.
It's just so hard to speculate right now,
right?
Because we've got companies in the oil patch that are making statements, very direct statements, that they're going to continue with the investments that they've committed to. ConocoPhillips with their North Slope investments, ExxonMobil with their Point Thompson investment. Hillcorp is making significant acquisitions and expanding their business here in Alaska. We've got both on the slope and in Cook Inlet. We've got some smaller players like Cook Inlet Energy that is now invested into the North Slope. We've got Brooks Range Petroleum that's going forward with their project. And then we've got Apache that's now starting to announce their project plans in the Cook Inlet Basin. So, I haven't seen anybody saying we're all done, and mm-hmm. Don't forget to turn off the lights before
right.
before the last person leaves.
Well, here's a question. I'll throw it out to all three of you. One of the things has been discussed in terms of what's happening with prices is that the shale oil, the new fracking oil is more expensive, and at some point the price falls low enough that those operators may shut in wells or at least not build new wells, and that's sort of where the price could come back up because the supply won't continue to be increased. What is our price? I mean, do we sort of stand in the same situation where Alaska oil is expensive to produce? Do we know sort of where the oil companies could start to say, we don't want to keep producing so much because the price is low? Anybody want to take that? Scott?
You need to look at two things. One, you need to look at what the cost is for production that's already been developed. Mm-hmm. And
so if you've already invested the money, there's no reason to stop.
You've already invested the money. Right. You're not going to stop. And that's the case both in for Alaskan oil and for shale oil. The price is not so low that the producers are going to start turning off their wells. The other thing you need to look at is the cost of new investment. And the cost of new investment generally, I think at the margin, tends to be lower in Alaska than it is in North Dakota, but some may have a different opinion on this. There are a lot of difference of opinions on it.
You mean in terms of the tax credits and all that?
Well, the tax credits play into it, but mm-hmm. Just the total cost of development of a field.
Because fracking costs a lot of money. There's a lot of technology involved.
Fracking costs a lot of money. And the thing about fracking is that the decline rates for the individual wells are extremely rapid. So for a well that's new, you get a good rate of flow for a year, maybe 2 years, and then it really starts to drop off quickly. So you have to keep investing in new wells continuously. So what the hope is looking forward, at least from the perspective of the oil price going back up, is that maybe not this year, but next year, that investment in new wells will fall off. And then the production from existing wells will also fall off, and that's when you'll see the overall production decline and the price start to come back.
Right. So that's something that'll take a while.
It'll take a while.
Here's another one on the same issue of time lag. As we're thinking about less money coming into our economy because of a lowered oil price, there's a whole series of things that have to happen before that actually hits the real economy, right? That there's, we're talking about, well, a reduction in workforce on the North Slope, or a reduction in expenditures from the state government. We're still on the current FY15 budget. A new budget wouldn't even start until next June. If we are going to see an economic decline, what's the timeline? And maybe you, and I'd throw that open to any of you, but I see you looking like you're ready to say something, Scott.
Well, I think we're looking at a low price environment for some time. There's about a $2 million barrel a day excess supply out there mm-hmm. in the market, and it's going to take a while for that to get worked off by an increase in demand and a decrease in supply. And I think that's the general feeling out there among analysts. It's just a question of timing, how long it'll take. I think it'll take a long time. I think that the
it'll take a long time for the price to come back
for
up.
The price to start to come back up. I think the in the public sector, they'll take a wait-and-see attitude. They'll recognize that something has to be done, and so they'll make some budget cuts, but they won't take a hatchet to the mm-hmm. budget. The capital budget has been cut to the bone, so they'll have to make some cuts in the operating budget, and there will be pain involved in that, but it won't be like 1985.
When we saw mass layoffs from the state and local government,
we saw significant layoffs. I wouldn't call them "quote unquote" mass layoffs. It wasn't like the way that the construction industry was mm-hmm. demolished.
Oh, I remember one day the city of Anchorage laying off 300 people, for example. We've certainly never seen anything like that since then.
Right, well, right. Then on the side of the oil patch, I think again it's a wait and see attitude. The oil companies don't make their budgets like the state of Alaska does when the price is at its maximum. So they have a lot more staying power in terms of the their investments that they have underway. And as Bill says, there's a lot going on out there that looks like it's going to continue even in a lower price environment, either because these are companies with deep pockets, or it's because they're companies that aren't beholden to the current price of oil to fund their capital. Mm-hmm. Their new
so
capital
it's investments. It's all something. If you expect it to happen tomorrow, it's not going to. It's going to be anything bad that's going to happen is maybe 6 months to a year out?
Longer.
Longer?
I think in terms of bad, if you're going to use that word, impactful, it could happen a little bit sooner. I mean, we may start to see some signs of bigger things to come in the next 6 to 12 months. But, you know, again, it comes down to what happens at the state government in terms of what they're doing. And then, you know, are we finding the bottom at 40 in terms of global oil prices, or is there more yet to be found in terms of the bottom? It's interesting, you know, there's a Wall Street Journal article today that talks about the fact that in interviewing Texas shale oil producers, they feel pretty good about a $40 barrel of oil still being profitable, 10% margins at 40. So what does that mean? You know, does that mean that they're going to continue cranking it out? Probably. Is that going to be, you know, an impact on how long this low price environment is going to continue, extreme, you know, much lower price environment? Or, you know, are other countries going to fall out that can't afford to maintain? You know, we've got other, it's not just shale. It's, it's the OPEC countries, it's Russia, it's other players who are also in this game to see who's going to still be standing at the end of the day in terms of keeping production going at current levels.
Yeah. So here's an email that came in, which is kind of on the state, the topic of the way we do our business as a state. I'm not sure we even need a response to this, but I'll read it. Alaska's always had the ability to eliminate the ups and downs of state income based on variable oil prices by simply implementing the Roger Cremo plan. For those of us who remember attorney Roger Cremo, who is also a statehood advocate, our permanent fund would be over double what it is today, and we would have over twice the amount of revenue per year available to the state for dividends, debt service, pensions, and operations. Isn't it time to have a good, complete public discourse about implementing the Cremo plan? And there have been other plans, and our guest Scott Goldsmith has talked quite a bit about the advantages of investing our one-time oil revenue and only using the income. Unfortunately, those discussions always seem to take place when we're short of money. When we have plenty of money, we just spend it, right? So now when you're short of money, it's the worst time to talk about
it. Well, it's no fun to talk about thrift when you've got plenty of money in your wallet. You
right.
know,
it's
just yeah, you're out there spending.
That's right. And here's another email regarding a previous caller's comments about bringing back the income tax and capping or ending the permanent fund. I would also like to add that each of us are taxed by Uncle Sam on our permanent fund dividends. We're effectively giving away state money to the U.S. government. So there'll be a lot of discussion in it, and it always comes back, and some of it sounds pretty familiar as we go through these tighter times. I guess as we go into the last segment of our show, talking about the oil price and the local economy, I'd like to get a sense of sort of a prediction or a sense of what is going to happen from our economists. You've got three economists in the room. We'll get three divergent opinions, and you can sort of weigh it as you like. I'm hearing people in the street sort of saying, gee, I don't know if I should buy a house. I don't know if I want to make that move or make that investment because the oil price is down and what might happen. And so it's important for people to have a somewhat accurate sense of what's happening with the economy because they're making decisions every day based on those. So who wants to jump in first with a prediction for the next 2-3 years, assuming, as Scott says, that the oil price is probably going to stay in this, not go way up anytime soon. Neil, you're looking like you could.
Well, I'll start just because we actually have a prediction. It's in black and white. It's been published in January a couple weeks ago. In a January issue of Alaska
Department
Economic
of
Trends.
Labor. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have a prediction for 2015. And, you know, I basically predicted that we would lose about 800 jobs this year, or about 0.5%. So it's a little more than what happened last year. I think it's a fairly conservative forecast. You know, there's a lot of detail in here. It's by industry. So someone, if they're really interested sort of in a detailed look at background and what we're expecting, there's a statewide forecast in there as well, and Fairbanks and Southeast as well. You know, they can look at this, and it's out there.
So half, that didn't sound like very much.
No.
That didn't sound too bad.
And but it's, you know, it's like we've all talked about it. It's so hard to predict how these, you know, the three things, you know, what's the industry going to do, you know, what the state's going to do, and the psychology, you know, how can you predict that? How are people going to react just in general? And I have absolutely no idea.
Well, what if I asked you to predict 2016? I mean,
well, if prices remain low, I would suspect that would become larger.
Yeah. So, Scott, do you want to chime in on this?
Yeah.
What do you think?
I would just say that we have a lot of assets going into this challenging economic period that we didn't have back in 85. And the most obvious one, of course, is our financial assets. We've got maybe $65 billion in the bank today in the permanent fund and the Constitutional Budget Reserve and other funds.
Readily spendable being like $10, $12 billion that the state has.
More than that actually is readily spendable, but I won't say how much. back in the mid-'80s, we had no Constitutional Budget Reserve. We had no readily spendable cash. We did have $15 to $20 billion in the permanent fund, but As we all know, the permanent fund is not easy to access. In addition to that, we have grown. We have invested in non-financial assets that make the community stronger today than it was before. Not only in infrastructure, you know, things like the convention center and so on that can be used by industry as well as the general population. But institutional assets as well. We have 12 native corporations that are all strong businesses. We have the permanent fund. We have the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, and so on. We have that capacity that we didn't have back then, and we have a dividend that's three times the size it was then. That provides stability, and we have a much larger senior population that's income is totally independent of the oil industry.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of things going for us that even recognizing what an uncertain time we're entering. Mm-hmm.
Let me give Bill Popp a shot at that. Do you have a prediction?
Well, we're going to give our main prediction at our event at the beginning of February, so I don't want to preempt that. I want people to come and listen.
Bill.
But but I will tell you that, you know, we're a glass half full organization in this scenario in the sense that we don't think that it's time to go climb up on the cliff edge yet and jump. You know, it's okay. Come back down
but
if you're thinking that way. But we'll let you know when it's time to go up to the cliff edge. And if you need a little help, we'll give you a shove. You know, but in other words, it's time to keep your eyes open, your head up, your ears, you know, listening closely to what's going on around you and to make informed decisions and to not do rash things. I agree wholeheartedly that the worst thing that we can do right now is panic because there's no reason to panic. It's not 1986 by any stretch of the imagination. And I think we've got some things that we can look forward to, including a very good tourism season next year, coming off a record high tourism season in Anchorage.
Great. Well, I want to thank all my guests. It's been fascinating. I've really enjoyed the discussion. You just heard Bill Popp from the Alaska Economic Development Corporation, Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, Neil Fried, an economist with the Alaska Department of Labor, and Scott Goldsmith, an emeritus professor at the University of Alaska. Next week, I'll be back with you again, and our topic will be Cook Inlet, status of a Cook Inlet as the Marine Symposium takes place here in Anchorage. My name's Charles Woolforth. Our producer was Monica Gokey. Evan Erickson was also in the booth. Thanks for joining us on Hometown Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.